Hi, this is Dave, and I just finished an amazing episode of the IC Disc Show. I had the privilege of doing several firsts all in that episode. One is I had the first time that I had a repeat guest. Neil Block of Baker & McKenzie was a repeat guest. The second unique thing is that this podcast will air on the date of Neil's last day before he retires after 50 years with Baker & McKenzie. So that's also interesting. And then the third interesting part about this podcast is that one of Neil's successors, Dave Barrick at Baker & McKenzie, was also on there. So we actually had two guests at the same time, and that made it a lot of fun. We really delved into a lot of different ways to structure a disc that just leaves me wanting to really call up all of our clients and say, hey, you need to think about some of these other structures for secondary and third discs. And so they really get into some just great detail, and it's really appropriate for advisors to family run businesses who are trying to transfer wealth as tax efficiently as possible. And it's also a great podcast for those who are CFOs or owners of closely held family businesses who are trying to transfer intergenerational wealth as tax efficiently as possible. So I hope you enjoy this interview as much as I did. And thanks again for listening to the IC Disc Show.
So this is a very special episode for several reasons. One, it's the first time we've had a guest on the show a second time, and that would be Neil Block of Baker & McKenzie. This is his second time to be on the IC Disc Show. Additionally, this is also the first time we've had two guests at the same time, and so Neil will be joined today by his colleague, Dave Barrick. And are you there, Dave?
I am. Hello.
Awesome. And then the third thing that's unique about this, it's with mixed feelings that I'm announcing that one of my all-time favorite IC Disc experts is retiring at the end of this month. You want to just talk a bit more about that, Neil?
Sure. Well, I'd say 50 years at the same firm is probably about enough time to say that I've had a full legal career, and so I'm going to be retiring. It's been the only law firm I've worked for since I got out of law school. I spent 2.5 years in the tax court before that, but once I joined Baker McKenzie in 1969, I've been there ever since. So it's all good things come to an end. It's about time that we do so now.
Okay. Well, thank you again for your dedication to the profession these last 50 years. So, so Neil was on episode 4 of the IC Disc Show. So anybody that wants to reference that and kind of go back to some of the background of the IC Disc, they can do so. So since we've already covered on that episode, we will skip that for this time. What I wanted to talk about were really several things. I wanted to talk about with Neil a bit of different IC Disc structure types, and then I want to hear more about Dave's practice and kind of some of the ways that dovetails with the IC Disc. Now, Neil, my understanding is that Dave is effectively your successor to the IC Disc practice. Is that accurate?
That's correct. He'll be the contact for Baker McKenzie on IC Disc questions in a general nature. We have two other people that will be involved. One is Maura Amnick Breen, who's our ERISA expert, and she specializes in the Roth IRA structure, at least knows everything about ERISA regarding Roth IRAs.
Okay.
And then David would be the contact for the wealth aspect, the wealth building aspect of the IC Disc structures.
Okay. So that sounds good. And in fact, pardon the fact I seem to be kind of bouncing around. Like I said, this is the first time we've had two guests on the show. Why don't we switch gears to Dave? And Dave, why don't you just share a bit of your background, where you went undergrad, law school, how long you've been at Baker McKenzie, and just talk a bit about your practice, because I know it encompasses more than IC Disc.
Sure. So I started off as an accountant. I went to DePaul University here in Chicago, and I'm an accounting major. I'm a CPA, worked in public accounting for about 10 years, specializing in tax. And then I went to law school at night at John Marshall Law School. I've got an LLM in employee benefits. And I focus my tax practice in wealth management, which at Baker McKenzie means really like trusted estates. So I deal a lot with wealthy multi-generational family groups. And I'll do the planning from a wealth transfer perspective. And that's one of the ways that Neil and I started working together more and more, because many of his clients that put in place a DISC happened to be family businesses, and they tended to be multi-generational. So this was just one aspect of their overall planning. So the DISC kind of fit nicely into my perspective, the general wealth planning for a family-owned business group.
Okay. Well, that sounds great.
Let me just interject.
Yeah, go ahead.
On that, because basically, Maury Ann, of course, knows everything about ERISA, and David would know structuring and how to maximize the use of the Roth IRA, for example, in getting ownership just outside of any strict Roth IRA structure somebody might have, but expanding it to using other members of the family to own the Roth IRA, other companies that would be involved. And so it's sort of a building block on a structure that's become successful up to now in its own right.
Okay. Another way to put that is, as Neil retires, we basically have a whole team coming in to back support what his practice has been for the past 50 years, because he's really incorporated a number of different practices.
Or said another way, perhaps, is that what Neil was able to do by himself, it's going to take a whole team of people to replace him. Is that
exactly
one way to look
exactly
at it?
Right.
Okay. Yeah. So with that, why don't we just dive into the Roth IRA? We spoke some on the episode 4, Neil did, as far as kind of the history of the Roth and kind of its winding its way through the courts. But the bottom line is that it's a structure that has withstood IRS challenge, and the comfort level with using this structure seems to be higher than it was several years ago. Is that a fair characterization, or how would either of you characterize the Roth IRA structure?
I would say that's a fair characterization. There's still one case involving a FISC which could have an impact on the legal aspects of the Roth IRA, but at this point we have now had the Roth IRA structure, which is the basically it's a disproportionate ownership structure, whereby the Roth IRA ownership is disproportionate to the ownership of the related supplier, which is a normal case, whereas the DISC is owned by the same person or persons that own the related supplier. So in and of itself, the structure itself is an estate planning vehicle, in that it's a shifting process of shifting wealth from the owner of a corporation to their sons, daughters, etc., with no gift tax or estate tax consequences. So it's become a fairly good estate planning vehicle. The reason it's stronger now than it was before is because we've now survived quite a few court cases. The most recent one was Summa Holdings, where the tax court stepped in and tried to put a stop to the structure, but then we appealed the case to three separate circuits because of the residency of the taxpayers. And as a result, we've gotten opinions from the First, Second, and Sixth Circuit upholding the Roth IRA structure, and we got 8 out of 9 possible votes in the Court of Appeals. So having the only outstanding authority being three U.S. Court of Appeals cases. We feel fairly comfortable that without any congressional action, this is a good structure.
Okay. And then, Dave, do you want to just maybe add to from your perspective on this structure, on some of what makes it appealing to your clients?
Sure. Yeah, sure. I mean, as a general premise, wealthy clients don't typically have a large holdings in IRAs or therefore Roth IRAs, just because a lot of it is inherited wealth. But the benefit of a Roth IRA is that you can pay the tax to get the Roth funded, and then as the earnings accrue on the underlying assets in that Roth, they're not subject to tax. And when they come out, they're not subject to income tax, and they're just distributed to the beneficiary. So from my perspective, although Roth IRAs, I think, were targeted at the rank and file, they really probably were used more so by the wealthier employees, because they were the ones that could afford to pay the tax up front to convert to a Roth IRA. So if you take that concept that you've got a no tax wrapper for a period of time, and if I can have one of the investments as a DISC, that's potentially highly successful. It's a nice match of two techniques. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think that it was a unique utilization of the two at the time when Neil came up with the idea.
Okay. Well, that's great. And why don't we just kind of walk through the mechanics, because this is a question I get a lot when I've brought this idea up with our clients. And their first comment is, well, none of my children have any IRAs. And they sort of feel like they're stuck there. So could one of you kind of, sort of go through the mechanics, kind of starting at the beginning? Like, in theory, if somebody does not currently have an IRA, how might they go about getting the ball rolling to make this structure work?
Let me start off and have Neil kind of fill in, because what you just said, David, is really what I just said a moment ago, is that a lot of wealthy clients don't have IRAs necessarily. And so it's important to recognize that the DISC Roth IRA is not a precursor that you have to have an IRA. So Neil, why don't you take it from there?
Okay. What I was going to say is, during my lectures, I commonly point out that the Roth IRA is a good estate planning vehicle for children, grandchildren, and sometimes even the unborn. And people say, well, how is a 3-month-old infant going to get an IRA when they have to earn earned income? And the answer is, in many cases, you just take a picture of the child and you pay them a modeling fee, and that starts you off with enough money to fund an IRA, and then convert that IRA into a Roth IRA. So, basically, even though you might not have the income to qualify for Roth IRA initially, you may have enough earned income to get an IRA and then convert it into a Roth IRA, which can be done almost immediately. It's called a backdoor IRA, a backdoor Roth IRA, but then that's how you get the thing in place. Basically, you have to have a custodian that will be the custodian for a Roth IRA, and most brokerage houses qualify. Getting some to be the custodian for a Roth IRA which owns a DISC has been a challenge, because they don't understand DISC and they don't understand that they would have to form the DISC themselves in order to get the ball rolling. So you have to choose, and we've got some custodians that will do the job with a Roth IRA owning a DISC. And we sort of recommend that. We sort of recommend that because the ones that we use don't charge a lot of time for their own education and trying to figure out what's going on. But once they get the Roth IRA, the Roth IRA will form a DISC, and that basically is the way the business starts. The DISC can. The reason this has been successful is it's avoided prohibited transactions, in that the Roth IRA does not use any of its assets in order to earn income from the DISC. The DISC is basically a device, as you've already pointed out in numerous broadcasts, this does not have to do anything. It's a paper corporation, and it only has to exist to exceed commission income and then distribute that income out. So basically the function is that by having the disc and having qualified exports, the profit on those exports in part is paid into the disc. The disc pays a commission, a dividend to the Roth IRA or to a holding company, which pays a dividend to the Roth IRA. And that now you're in business on accumulating wealth. There is a tax, an upfront tax on the distribution of the disc dividends to an IRA or to a holding company. So that tax has to be paid at normal corporate rates. But once that tax is paid and the funds are in the Roth IRA, they become reinvested tax-free until withdrawal.
Yeah, and that corporate tax rate being the 21% current corporate tax rate, correct?
Yeah, incidentally, that's something that the instructions for the Form 990-T for the UBIT tax says to use the trust rate, but we've got the service convinced that it's the corporate rate that's used, and they were supposed to change the instructions, but they have changed their computer programs so that when you pay at the corporate rate, you're not questioned anymore.
Okay. And so, and then once that the dividends are paid to the Roth and the Roth pays the tax, then that money can be invested in any vehicle that the custodian is comfortable with, correct? Like mutual funds or such, correct?
Well, the way we've set it up is in many cases, the clients aren't interested in using the custodian. So then what we have what we do is have the Roth IRAs establish an account with a brokerage firm of the client's choice, so that the funds will then, after they're paid out as a dividend into the Roth IRA, the Roth IRA will then invest as directed by the beneficiaries into an account, which is, you know, could be any account. It could be Merrill Lynch, it could be Morgan Stanley, it could be, you know, any one of those companies, Schwab, for example. And as long as they accept the Roth IRA account, they can now invest as they wish with the advice and experience of the brokerage house if they want.
Okay. And so, like, for just to show the magnitude of this, let's just assume you had a company that had a disc that was producing $1 million a year of IC disc commissions, and there were two children that whose Roth they wanted to own it. So you get the IRAs established, convert them to the Roths, and then those Roths would actually purchase the initial stock to capitalize the disc, correct?
Yes, although if you want to follow the cases that we tried, the SUMA cases, what happened there was that the Roth IRAs formed the disc, and then they formed a holding company, a C corporation holding company, and then dropped the disc into the holding company. So that as the disc commissions were earned, the disc paid a dividend to a holding company, and that way the Roth IRA did not have to pay any tax on the disc distribution. The corporation did, and that was all under the control of the client and its accountants. Then when the tax was paid at the corporate level, the balance was paid out as a dividend to the Roth IRA, and since dividend income normally is tax-free to a Roth IRA, these dividends from the C corporation were tax-free because of the tax already having been paid up front at the corporate level. And this is all pointed out in the court opinions and blessed by them, so that structure works quite well. You don't have to have the holding company. You can have the dividends paid into the Roth IRA, but then the Roth IRA pays the tax on the dividends at the corporate rate. And some taxpayers find it a little messy to have to rely on the Roth IRA to pay the tax, and so that's where they
sure
use the holding company.
Well, that makes sense. And then when you just look at the magnitude of this, so in this example, there's $1 million being paid to the holding company or holding companies. Let's assume that there was just a single Roth for this point. And so they're paying $210,000 for the UBIT tax. And then that remaining $790,000 is being distributed to the DISC. And then again, that money grows tax-free. So if you would imagine, like if somebody had just a 5-year-old child, let's say, and they did this for 10 years, you're talking about $7.9 million going in to the Roth. And then because of the time value of money and compounding, you know, that number over 30, 40, 50 years, right, could grow to tens and even, you know, $100 million, right?
In the cases that we tried, I believe, I can't remember how many years were involved, but it got a lot of play because they say a $2,500 investment got converted into $3 million a year for each of the two children of the owner of the company. So it can grow quite rapidly. But remember, you're not saving, you're making savings some tax because the corporate rate's a bit lower than the individual rate. But the savings is not from the payment of the DISC commission and then the commission dividend into the Roth IRA. The savings is the tax-free growth in the Roth IRA.
Right. Right. And so then
in the case we had, even though there were $6 million, I believe, in the two Roth IRAs, that all came from the DISC commission. There was no really income that was earned by the Roth IRA or any basic tax savings because tax was paid up front in that case.
Right. Right. That makes sense. And then, you know, another benefit that that we didn't mention, I know that is my understanding correct that in some states, qualified retirement assets are effectively creditor proof, and would the Roth fall under that umbrella?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, that's correct.
So so that's another, you know, kind of a perk to it. Okay, well that is very helpful. So let's switch gears a little bit and go to Dave. So Dave, maybe give kind of a typical example of how you're seeing the Roth used as part like of an overall wealth transfer strategy and just, you know, kind of speaking generically. Could you maybe give an example of how this might be one of several elements that you might help a client with?
I'll give you a kind of a typical profile of a client that we work with. And I found this when working with Neil, as I met the clients, when they started asking me other questions outside of the DISC area, their profile looked very much like my typical client profile. It's just that not all my clients have DISCs, for example. So the concept is this: if you build a family business, you start accumulating wealth in the business, and now you're looking for ways to minimize income taxes and potentially pull money out of the company and get it to the right individuals within the family. And so a DISC can be one of those techniques. You can bifurcate where the wealth is generated. If you generate it solely in the business, then that owner upon death is going to transfer it to whoever the descendants and pay an estate tax. If you can bifurcate some of it to a ownership in a DISC, gather some wealth, pull some money out of the company through a DISC strategy, now you can have different owners of that DISC and you can transfer some wealth that way. If you take your ownership of the business and you transfer it to your children, that's another way to transfer some of the wealth. But we're limited, each taxpayer, as to how much they can actually give for free. And so this year it's roughly $11.6 million. It's indexed for inflation. It was doubled under the 2017 Tax Act. And potentially that goes back down to roughly $7 million in 2026 if Congress doesn't extend the law. So families that have businesses are kind of struggling with, I spend my whole life building up the wealth in this business, and then upon my death, the government's going to get 40% of it, and my family only gets 60%. Even though I've been paying income tax all the way along to build the new plant expansion and so on and so on. And so we look at different strategies that we can utilize to minimize the transfer tax to families to get the wealth spread out amongst the right buckets, so to speak, or generations or descendants. And of those different techniques, the DISC is just one of our tools. It's one that we can add to a family that's got exports.
Okay.
And the point with the DISC, of course, in the SUMA cases, remember, we had the father and the two children. Basically, all of the income in the Roth IRAs represented a transfer of wealth from the father's ownership to the children without any gift tax. And also, when he dies, it'll be without any estate tax. So that's the for the wealthy, so to speak, that's the advantage. Could we just switch now to a couple of other planning techniques that you can still use with the DISC?
Sure.
One is, in addition to using it to create wealth for the children and the grandchildren, what have you, the DISC can be used to transfer wealth to key employees. And what we found is, in lieu of a bonus, we have key employees own stock of a DISC. And as a result, the income from the DISC becomes capital gains income, or the employees can establish their own Roth IRAs and have the DISC earn income and then pay as a dividend to the Roth IRAs. And that, again, will avoid avoid any tax to the employees. So that's another way of shifting wealth. And it was the topic of conversation with the Sixth Circuit, which when he was trying to point out that it wasn't only the very wealthy that could be advantaged by this structure, but the less wealthy, the employees, for example.
And as I understand it, there are several benefits through effectively paying the bonuses or having DISC commission income in lieu of bonuses. And that is that the payroll taxes would be less by the employer, less by the employee share, and then you have the lower tax rate on the dividend income versus if it came out as ordinary income.
There's no employment. Yes, no employment taxes and capital gains tax on the DISC dividends, whether to the Roth IRA or to the shareholder himself. The structure is used not only for Roth IRAs, for example. It just uses additional compensation to the key employees.
And now go ahead, Neil.
We actually have structured it so that the owner of the company can almost determine how much of the DISC income goes to the specific employees or to himself, because in many cases he's one of the owners of the DISC. So there's a fair amount of flexibility in the structure.
Yeah, and so with that, we've seen this scenario, and one of them is to have two DISCs, like one owned by the related supplier and then one owned by like the key employees. And then to first pay out the kind of bonus portion and then the remainder to be paid to the DISC owned by the related supplier. Is that similar to some of the structures you've seen?
Yes. There is a possibility of having just employees own the DISC and then have have their commission not be part of portion that's allowable under the code, because there's a ruling that says that might be an arm's length commission, not a safe harbor commission. So we don't recommend it because it looks a little bit too greedy. But basically, what we do is we take the normal DISC commission that's allowable if the owner of the company received it, and then use that same amount to be in part the bonus for the employees.
And what do you do if there's like, say, five or six people on that management team that's receiving the bonuses? Do you end up with like separate DISCs for each, or how do you handle if an employee leaves or is fired? How do you handle that sort of turnover at the executive ranks?
That's a good question. And what we usually do is we don't have the DISC owned by the employees. We usually have a limited liability company own the DISC and then have the employees be members of the limited liability company. And then we would have the owner of the related supplier be the manager of the LLC, and he would determine what the DISC benefits were to the individual employees.
And I've seen that language that you give that manager. I think the term is broad discretion on how the funds are distributed from the LLC to the to the recipients.
Yeah, in other words, we have been involved. One of the things we do is we can do the management agreement for the LLCs to accommodate how it's going to be distributed out. And that's Bob Wilson is the person that generally will draft those documents. So as I was saying before, we have a team that can handle all the aspects of the thing. So from planning to implementation.
Okay, so that's on the employee ownership of the DISC. But I sense that there were some other structures you had in mind.
Well,
what else?
One of the important uses of the DISC, and this is one that has not been challenged in court, or there's no court decisions, but to the extent that we have a U.S. company that does exporting, and that U.S. company is owned in part or solely by a foreign corporation, if that foreign corporation is in a country that has a treaty with the United States, then if the treaty is later in time through the DISC provisions, which these days almost all of them are because the last DISC provision was in about 1989 or something, or 90. In that case, the treaty provisions will prevail over the DISC provisions. So under the code, DISC dividends to a foreign shareholder are taxed as unrelated business taxable income. It's income effectively connected with U.S. trade or business subject to tax at ordinary rates. But under the treaty, you cannot do that unless you have a permanent establishment in the United States. And ownership of a U.S. subsidiary does not create a permanent establishment. So because of the treaty provisions, and you have to read each treaty very carefully, but because of the treaty provisions, the DISC dividends do not get taxed at ordinary income rates, but at the withholding tax rates on the treaties. So that's another structure that's been in place and benefits foreign shareholders, and they can be large or small.
So just to have an illustration of that, let's just say a foreign company has a wholly owned U.S. subsidiary, and the DISC is established. Would the shareholder of the DISC be the foreign corporation?
It would be the foreign corporation or a subsidiary of it in the same country.
Okay. And then, so let's just say that there was $1 million of commission paid in a year. Can you walk me through kind of the mechanics? Let's say it was England, let's say, is where the company was based. Or just a country that you're kind of familiar with the treaty, specific rates, to just see how that $1 million ends up getting flowing through to the ultimate foreign corporation.
Sure. Let's just say we had $1 million of DISC commission. There's some confusion sometimes as to, but the DISC isn't allowed to earn the entire commission, just the portion of it, depending on the safe harbor rules. But let's assume there's a $2 million profit and $1 million goes into the DISC. And the DISC now is owned by a UK corporation. And the treaty now applies. And so we take the position that the DISC dividends to the UK corporation, let's put it this way, the $1 million of commission to the DISC is deductible by the U.S. company. The $1 million of income to the DISC is tax-free to the DISC because the DISC is a tax-exempt entity. The DISC dividends then would normally be taxed as effectively connected income, but under the treaty, it said we would apply the treaty withholding rate. And for dividends out of the U.S. to the U.K., the rate is either, I think, generally 5% or zero. And depending on the holding of the company and how long it's been held and other factors. But in any event, we've now got a deduction at, say 21% or even higher if the company is not paying at the corporate rates, and the income going into the UK company is taxed at 5% or zero, and under the UK provisions, there's no tax in the UK.
Wow, that's really can be really powerful. I've also seen where under that same structure, they'll do kind of a blending, like we talked about earlier, with the employee-owned DISC, where they might structure that where they'll have some of the employees in the U.S., be either a part owner in the disc or the owner of the second disc. And so you're kind of combining the two strategies there.
Well, I think the point that you're raising is that there's no limit to the number of discs that can be created in a what they call a controlled group.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to use a disc for one purpose and another disc for a different purpose and a third disc for even a different purpose, there's no prohibition.
Okay. So Dave, I know you're listening quietly. What thoughts has that prompted in your mind based on some of these conversations that you'd like to add some commentary to?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the first thought is that the disc has survived a number of years and is kind of still thriving. And I think Neil can probably add a little history to that, but that's something that we constantly have been looking at to see if, well, is there going to be a change in the law that eliminates the ability to do a disc? And I think our opinion is not that we know of, although you never know. And the second point is that many times it's highly treaty sensitive. And so I think maybe we've been fortunate to have a kind of a hold on new treaties recently. But that's always something that impacts the analysis. And I think that's something that, you know, Neil brings kind of a deep history of how this has all worked out over the years. You know, do you want to comment on that?
I think one of the caveats, if I'm going to use a legal word, in the use of the treaty is you have to look to see what the country that you're dealing with is going to do with the disc commissions. And in some countries, such as Japan or France, you might have difficulty under local taxing provisions because they'll treat the disc dividends or the disc income the same as subpart F income for U.S. purposes. In other words, it won't get the benefits that the normal corporation might get in the treaty country because of the fact that the disc is tax exempt.
Yeah, I can see why that is so country specific.
So it's important on the structuring on the front end to determine, you know, where the right setup is. And then, you know, you want to just talk about your experience over the past 50 years with legislation?
Yes. Well, over the past 50 years, the disc has always been on the way out. It was, I think the disc came in the 70s under the Gerald Ford administration as a Republican measure to encourage exports and give exporters a tax benefit. A few years later, the Republicans decided they didn't want the disc anymore for whatever reason. And the Democrats said, no, keep it, because the disc was being used by small exporters to their advantage, and they didn't want the small exporters to be disadvantaged. Subsequently, the disc was, quote, was found to be in violation of the General Agreement of Tariffs and Trade, and the Foreign Sales Corporation was organized to replace the disc. The Foreign Sales Corporation was a foreign corporation in a selected qualifying jurisdictions that had the same benefits as the disc had, and was being used by the larger corporations to reduce their tax rate by about 15%. But rather than getting rid of disc, they kept the disc as a, quote, interest charge disc, and basically made the disc more attractive to small exporters because there's a $10 million deferral amount that they allowed, and the FISC had unlimited amounts. So at the same time, the disc, which was a deferral mechanism at the time, allowed all the disc income to be repatriated tax-free. So that was an encouragement for the larger corporations to go into the FISC. But the disc survived. And then when the capital gains rates came in, there became an arbitrage advantage to having the disc pay dividends to shareholders so that the dividends got taxed at capital gains rates while the related supplier got ordinary income deductions. So that moved along, and then I can't remember what year it was, but then there was a proposal to eliminate disc altogether. And because there was such a hue and cry from small exporters, that failed. And then I think there's been a number of attempts to limit disc, but the most recent one was I think the Tax Reform Act of 1917, whatever they call it, or 2017, in which under the Senate bill, this was to be eliminated. But once again, the lobbying groups for the small exporters convinced the one Republican whose vote was needed to pass the bill to oppose any change in the DISC provisions. And as a result, the DISC provisions remained intact. So it's always had people trying to get rid of it, and the IRS doesn't like it because it's an entity that doesn't do anything but saves taxes.
Sure.
Presently, as David points out, Congress is so split that they can't agree on anything. So until that gets resolved, we don't see any change in DISC.
Mm-hmm. Hey, one quick question to go back on the Roth-owned DISC. Let's say you have somebody that owns a business they export, but let's just say they have no heirs. If that person was, say, like 25 years old and planned to, you know, work for decades, I'm guessing that using the Roth structure would still make sense for them. But maybe if somebody was in their 60s, it may not make so much sense, you know, if they're not using an heir strategy, but just a tax saving strategy. Could one of you comment on if you've explored that issue and if there seems to be kind of a rule of thumb of kind of the age of the person where it starts to be more attractive or less attractive?
I'll take a first crack. I mean, I think it's a combination of the dollar amount and the age. So that if it's a deferral mechanism, then it doesn't really matter how old you are. If you think that you're going to use the money in the future and you want to minimize the income tax in the short term, if it's a dollar amount, like you've already, maybe you have heirs, but you've already given them enough. And so you might just leave the Roth to charity, for example. And it's, you know, you could do that. Most people, the general premise, when we talk about Roths, we're saying, I'm going to pay tax on my IRA and then convert it to a Roth and have it grow tax free. And so by definition, I'm going to leave it to somebody. You wouldn't pay tax up front and then leave the Roth to charity, for example.
Right.
With a DISC Roth scenario, you're not paying. I mean, we said this at the beginning, but I think it's really important to highlight. You don't need a big IRA to convert to a Roth. You can start up, so long as you can start up an IRA. You can start up the Roth with nominal funding, and then it can be the beneficiary or the recipient of the distributions from the DISC. So it's a business planning tool. It's less of a, obviously, a retirement tool. So your example with a 60-year-old that doesn't have descendants still may do it just to have like a little nest egg that they will take out after they sell their business or what have you.
Okay. And I guess another use of it for somebody without the heirs is just the asset protection aspect, if they're in a state that recognizes that.
Mm-hmm.
Right,
totally.
Correct. Say the person had a $20 million net worth, mostly in the business, that's exposed, but over the course of, say, 5 years, they're able to basically transition $5 million of that $20 million to their Roth-owned DISC. You know, that may have its own appeal just from the asset protection. So, okay.
Can I interject
yeah.
with one case that we have right now? And this is one where actually there's a mother and she's got, I think, 3 or 4 children, and basically she's been transferring the stock to them and suddenly realized she wanted to spend some money. So she had them establish a DISC owned by her so that she could get the money in her own hands so she could spend it and take her own vacations and pamper herself for the rest of her life. So this was a reverse estate planning vehicle where she wanted the money back in her own hands. So that not every person who's dealing with wealth necessarily wants to use it for leaving the money to their heirs, but spending it for themselves.
Okay, that's that is interesting. Okay. Is there any other ownership structures that come to mind, Neil, that we need to talk about?
Well, yeah, there's a number of them. Apart from the IRAs and the treaty country ownership, there's another thing, too, that is overlooked sometimes, and that's a partnership. In many cases, there's a company that's closely held but has a partnership with a, let's say, a publicly held company or a joint venture. And if they form a partnership, the partnership income earned by the closely held company will qualify for DISC benefits, because if the partnership is exporting, each partner is deemed to be an exporter in his own right and therefore can take advantage of the DISC provisions, even though the company that's doing the exporting is quite large and is mostly held by a C corporation, which has no use for the DISC. So that would be one. One advantage. Let me see what else we have here. We have the, as I said before, we use the, for estate planning purposes, we don't need the IRAs. You can just have the DISC owned by the children or grandchildren of the owner. It's not necessary to use a Roth IRA or an IRA structure. It's just simply another way of shifting the wealth. The same as to the employees, but in this case it would be children.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And I've seen, is my understanding correct? I've seen situations where folks have gotten in trouble with that because they'll take an existing DISC and transfer some of the stock to the children, and then perhaps creating a valuation issue, so that the best practices would be to form a brand new DISC. Is that accurate?
Well, actually, we have had some difficulty with estate planners when they see the value of the DISC. You know, the DISC is churning all this income. It's one of the greatest investments that you can make. So they start putting a value on the DISC at a very high level. But there is a revenue procedure, RevProc 8154, which is normally a bad ruling, but it does say that the fair market value of DISC stock at any given time is book value.
Oh, okay. So that reduces that risk of a valuation issue upon transferring it.
Right. Now, in many cases, we have a DISC owned by an S corporation, which is fine because the S corporation income flows through to the shareholders, and they pay tax and capital gains rates. But the disadvantage is it takes away planning opportunities for the shareholders to use their own Roth IRA or do their own generation skipping. So in some cases, rather than using a DISC owned by the S corporation, the shareholders of the S corporation may be better off owning the DISC stock. Situation which generally results when we have farming companies. Remember that the only benefits that the DISC can take in the normal course are income from exports. But in many cases, if you take a farm, for example, the farm was originally found by mom and dad, and they had four or five kids. And then mom and dad got older, and they wanted to keep the kids in the business. So each kid got a little bit of the business. One got the crops, one got the processing facilities, one got the machinery and equipment, one took care of the marketing. And so as a result, you might have four or five different companies or entities earning income from the farming operation, but that results in a very small amount of income from the export activities. So one way we've gotten around that is to form a partnership of all of the family members, so that the members become, each one of those little businesses now contributing to the partnership, and the partnership export income is now the entire export profit that would have been the case if mom and dad had still owned the farm.
So, oh, I see. Okay.
So what we do is, and basically our partnership people get involved in this transaction. And for the most part, they've been saying that, you know, really what they've had all along is a partnership anyhow. They've just divided it up. But in many cases,
right,
you find that these families sit down and decide how much each person's going to make anyway. So it's also possible for unrelated parties, but you have to watch it a little bit more closely. So you make sure that the partnership agreement provides for what the different partnerships want. When we use an LLC, for example, we use different classes of LLC interests in order to get the parties' desires the way they want them. And in some cases, it's used to give, you know, one party a greater percentage of the profit than the other one would have where you wouldn't get that with just a straight disk ownership.
And speaking of the farming go ahead, Neil.
No, it's okay. Go ahead.
So speaking of the farming operations, I had a question yesterday about a company that it's a farming company, and their situation, though, they sell to a co-op, and the co-op exports a portion of what they're selling them, which on the surface appears to be problematic to qualify for the DISC because of the commingling of the grain. Is that something you've had any experience with co-ops, and or is there a way to make that work from a structural perspective or operational perspective that you've seen?
The answer is yes. I've been involved in the co-op situation. I've actually been involved with trying to get a ruling from the IRS on how the co-op would work. And it's not been very easy. The service is still refusing to give rulings, as far as I know. One of the problems in the co-op is how you measure the DISC profit, because what do you do with the expenses of the farmer? And when you sell to the co-op, what is the co-op's basis, and what's the farmer's share of the co-op profits, and how's that going to be taxed, and is there going to be an offset for his profits for DISC purposes against his crop growing expenses? So there's a number of issues that have to be worked through in terms of the co-op. But basically, the co-op structure does lend itself to the DISC benefits, but getting the rulings from the service that would bless the structure have been difficult.
Okay. Dave, do you have anything to add? Since again, we've kind of kept you out of the conversation for the last 10 minutes.
That's okay. I suppose I just would note that the new SECURE Act, that it's effective January 1st, changed the stretch out rules for IRAs, which would include Roth IRAs, meaning that you can't stretch it out over the life expectancy of the beneficiary. It's got to be paid out 10 years after the death of the participant, essentially. And so not great, but I don't think it has much of an impact. It just means that if you do a DISC Roth technique, then once the owner passes away, it's going to be distributed out of that Roth IRA within 10 years. Still not subject to tax, but something to
okay.
Know.
Okay. Well, thank you for that clarification.
I might add one thing. It becomes sort of the holy grail of DISC, but somebody's new to DISC, is that you want to have the DISC owned by a shareholder who's going to at least get the capital gains rate on DISC dividends. And
okay.
Capital gains rate, I'm talking about the 23.8% rate, not the normal, because DISC dividends are taxed as ordinary income, but if you're an individual, you pay tax at the capital gains rate. So this sort of leaves out corporations owning DISC stock, because the corporations will pay tax on DISC dividends at regular corporate rates. And then the dividends from the corporation to its shareholders will be taxed again, so you'll have double taxation.
So right.
The theory is that the DISC stock is to be owned by a pass-through entity or a low-tax entity.
Gotcha.
And yep. That's why in the foreign shareholder situations, because we get the treaty benefit, we can have a corporation own DISC stock without suffering the detriment.
Okay. Wow. Well, we have really covered a lot, and the time has flown by. Normally, this is where I would ask for your contact information, Neil, but given your retirement, perhaps we should get Dave's contact information. Dave, could you share your contact information?
Sure. I can be contacted at Baker McKenzie at my email, which is my name, David.Berek, that's B as in boy, E-R-E-K, at BakerMcKenzie.com. And my telephone number is 312-861-8184.
Okay. And then the person that the other attorney, Neil, mentioned, the female, Arissa, expert, you would be able to forward the appropriate questions to her, correct?
Right, right. In Neil's absence, we're putting together a team, and that would be Maura McBreen of our benefits, comp and benefits group. Bob Wilson puts together a lot of the structure. He's a paralegal in our corporate practice. And then we bring in other collaborative attorneys as needed. So we recognize that we had some very big shoes to fill with Neil retiring, and we're encouraged by the challenge. So we're looking forward
to it. I might mention that Maura Ann McBreen, is the co-attorney with me, co-counsel in a case called Swanson Tool, which is a IRA disc case. And so she was actually on the brief and wrote the ERISA portion, which frankly won the case. So she's very, very good at theory. And the only other thing is I did publish a BNA portfolio this last year on disc.
Okay.
So even though I'm not going to be in the office, if anybody wants my learned opinion on the disc stuff, they can look at the portfolio.
Okay. That sounds good. And with just a couple of minutes left, Neil, do you mind retelling one of my favorite stories you tell about the benefits of specialization? When you were in law school and the professor talked about the more narrow your focus, the less bright you have to be. Do you mind just kind of retelling that?
Sure. One of the gems I kept from law school was in my corporations class. The instructor was in private practice, and he said, just a word of advice, he says, you don't have to be the sharpest tack in the shed, but if you know more about a subject than anybody else, the world will be the path to your doorstep. And I took that to heart. So when I came off the tax court and became an attorney with Baker McKenzie, the disc stuff was just being introduced. And I said, what better way to become a specialist than to get in on the ground floor? I didn't realize there was something called a Foreign Western Hemisphere Trade Corporation before that, but that's what I did. So that became my guiding light. And so about 20 years into my practice, I was in the elevator in the Prudential building where our offices were. And somebody said, Neil, do you remember this professor from law school? And I said, well, of course. And it was Mr. Kaplan. I said, he said, well, here he is. And there he was. And so I said, you said something to me that was my guiding light. He said, what I say? And I told him about the sharpest tack in the shed business. And you know what he said?
Why?
Did I say that?
that is great. And then lastly, I would like to share my other. So that story had a huge comment by your professor had a huge impact on your career. And although he did not make that comment to me directly, I still picked that up somewhere. And that's why our business is solely focused on the IC disc. And to the best of my knowledge, we're the only firm like ours that's focused purely on the IC disc. But the other big lesson I learned from you, do you remember about 8 years ago, I called you about a question and you answered the question in like 3 minutes. And then, you started inquiring about, my family and the weather and such. And so I quickly interrupted you because I said, hey, Neil, at your billing rates, it's like, $20 a minute for talking to you. So, we might need to cut this call short. And I don't know if you remember this call, but you said, well, hold on, Dave. I mean, you are correct. You're going to get a bill for our time today. And don't worry, I won't charge you for anything, past that point. But he said, I'm the cheapest attorney you'll ever have. And I said, why? I mean, your billing rates are, on an hourly basis or some of the highest of any attorneys we work with. And you said, yeah, you're going to get a bill for this conversation and it's going to be a few hundred dollars, but somebody else paid me $10,000 to research this matter before. And thus I had the answer off the top of my head. And that's why, Dave, that the more expert somebody is, the more specialized they are, the higher their hourly rate must be, because otherwise they cannot capture the full value they're delivering because somebody else has already, paid for them to get the research. And I've never forgotten that. And I keep that in mind as I hire experts and professionals in the future. And I've seen firsthand when you have a generalist and you ask them a question, their first response is, well, let me start the research on that. Cause I don't know that answer off the top of my head. So anyway, do you remember that story or that conversation?
I remember you relaying it to me, so I think it must be
okay. Okay. So, and is there anything? And Dave, would you agree with Neil's point that it's not a bad strategy to use experts?
I agree. One of the comments that I make to my clients is, the more you talk to me, the more money you're going to save. So, the more you can spend on, the more that you can invest into specialists or experts, the more profitable you're going to be. The question for the client is, when do I need an expert?
Right.
When we get to our practice areas, it's pretty apparent.
Well, awesome. Well, gentlemen, again, I can't believe the time has flown so quickly. I could listen to Neil Block stories for hours upon end, but all things must come to an end. Neil, thank you again for just being such a great resource for my firm and our clients for the last decade or two. And I just wish you the best of luck in your retirement.
Well, David, thank you very much. I appreciate it. I appreciate being able to close off my career by being on your podcast.
Yeah. All right. If I was smart, I would make this my last podcast and just end on a high note and just retire the podcast. But we'll have to think about that. Well, thanks a lot, guys. You both have a great day, okay?
You bet. Take care.
Thank you.
All right. Bye.
There we have it. Another great episode. Thanks for listening in. If you want to continue the conversation, go to icdiscshow.com. That's icdiscshow.com. And we have additional information on the podcast, archived episodes, as well as a button to be a guest. So if you'd like to be a guest, go select that and fill out the information, and we'd love to have you on the show. So that's it. We'll be back next time with another episode of the IC Disc Show.